This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. Pope Francis on Sunday called for an Easter truce in Ukraine and, in apparent reference to Russia, questioned the value of planting a victory flag, quote, on a heap of rubble.
Si ripongano le armi. Si inizi una tregua pasquale.
Francis spoke at the end of a Palm Sunday service for about 50,000 people in St. Peter's Square, the first time since 2019 that the public was allowed to attend following 2 years of scaled-back services because of COVID-19 restrictions. Since the war began in Ukraine, Francis has only mentioned Russia specifically in prayers, such as during a special global event for peace on March 25th, but he has referred to Russia by using terms such as invasion and aggression. Moscow describes the action it launched on February 24th as a special military operation. Francis has already rejected that terminology, calling it a war. Palm Sunday marks the start of Holy Week, leading up to Easter Sunday in the Roman Catholic Church on April 17th this year. French voters streamed to polling stations Sunday for the first round of a tense contest for the presidency, with incumbent Emmanuel Macron's hopes of re-election clouded by a strong challenge from the far right's Marine Le Pen. Macron, a centrist, is asking France's 48 million voters for a second five-year term, but he's up against 11 other candidates and widespread voter anger and apathy. Le Pen, in particular, has tapped into the foremost issue on many voters' minds, living costs that have soared amid the disruptions of war in Ukraine and the economic repercussions of Western sanctions on Russia. Follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. The killing of an unarmed Palestinian woman in the West Bank is the latest in an Israeli-Palestinian violence as tensions soar during Ramadan. AP correspondent Naomi Shannon reports.
The Israeli army shot the woman at a military checkpoint near Bethlehem after she was asked to stop and ignored warning shots. That came after a Palestinian militant was killed by the Israeli army for his part in the deadly shooting in Tel Aviv earlier this week. Hundreds of Palestinians gathered in his hometown of Jenin to mourn his loss. This year, Ramadan coincides with major Jewish holidays, leading to heightened tensions. Speaking to his cabinet, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett vows that Israel is going on the offensive to tackle Palestinian attacks. I'm Naomi Shannon.
Shanghai on Sunday discharged over 11,000 recovered COVID-19 patients, and health authorities emphasize they must be allowed to return home despite the lockdown that has severely restricted movement in China's largest city. Quote, we hope their family and community will not worry about them or discriminate against them, said the director of the Shanghai Health Commission. Shanghai has been under lockdown since March 28th, and authorities said Saturday the strict measures would be lifted in areas with no new cases in the last 14 days following another round of mass testing. The United States on Saturday advised its citizens to reconsider traveling to China due to arbitrary enforcement of local laws and COVID-19 restrictions, particularly in Hong Kong and Shanghai. U.S. officials cited a risk of parents and children being separated. Tunisians on Sunday protested against President Kais Saied, accusing him of imposing one-man rule in the North African country after he dissolved parliament last month. Many members of parliament participated in the protest on Sunday, which took place with a heavy presence of anti-riot police. A delegation from the European Parliament will visit Tunisia on Monday to urge the return of the democracy established after the 2011 revolution that ended the autocratic rule of the late President Ben Ali. Recapping our top story, Pope Francis on Sunday called for an Easter truce in Ukraine and, in an apparent reference to Russia, questioned the value of planting a victory flag, quote, on a heap of rubble. Francis spoke at the end of a Palm Sunday service for about 50,000 people in St. Peter's Square, the first time since 2019 that the public was allowed to attend following 2 years of scaled-back services because of COVID-19 restrictions. Find more at voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
The legislators are not don't have that kind of guarantee that executives have. In fact, as a legislator, by virtue of Section 68 of the Constitution, says if you move from one political party that sponsored you and you won the election to another party without justifiable reason, you stand the risk of losing your seat.
A Nigerian High Court dismisses a petition to remove the governor of Cross River State from office.
The belief that I hold so dear, that I'm supposed to stand for the truth and always ensure that I bring out whatever wrongs are happening and advocate for quality health services in our country. I will continue advocating more and I will continue serving my people diligently.
The president of the Residents Doctors Association of Zambia resigns as a medical practitioner from the civil service.
Over 195 million is being taken away from the Moro people in the name of ransom. As of date, the statistics we have is about 325 Moro people that are murdered by the separatists.
And Cameroonian separatists attack a village on the Nigerian border. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A Nigerian High Court has dismissed a petition to remove the governor of Cross River State from office. In its ruling, the court says the petition failed to meet constitutional provisions that enable the removal of a sitting governor. This after Governor Ben Ayade from the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, defected to the ruling All Progressives Congress, or APC, ahead of next year's general election. The move, Ayade says, was due to his close working relationship with President Muhammadu Buhari. The governor also sacked some members of his administration after they refused to join his new party. It prompted the opposition PDP to file the court petition to remove the governor from office. For the latest development in Nigeria's Cross River State, I reach attorney Leonard Anyongo in the state capital, Calabar.
The Nigerian constitution clearly spells out the modes or the ways or the situation a state governor in Nigeria can be removed from office. If you look at Section 180, Section 188, Section 189 of the Nigerian 99 constitution as amended, it clearly tells you or states that a governor of a state can be removed where he resigns from office, or he dies in office, or is incapacitated by virtue of sickness or otherwise. And lastly, by such as Section 189, it can be impeached by the legislators. So defection from one political party to another is not contemplated in the Nigerian constitution as presently constituted. So it was on the basis of that that the court found that the governor of Cross River State was indeed, it was his defection from the then political party, the People's Democratic Party, to the ruling All Progressive Congress, is in tandem with the law.
There seem to be a lot of defections. Why do we see a lot of these defections ahead of elections in Nigeria?
There may not be a very clear-cut political ideology of these different political parties that exist in Nigeria at the moment. And then, of course, politicians try to harness their interest. In some political decision of a particular political party, your interest may not be adequately catered for in terms of internal party democracy, where your aspiration may not be guaranteed. In the likes of maybe you want to vie for an office and they want to call in Nigeria, a level playing ground is not afforded such a member. And then, of course, remember that the Nigerian constitution also guarantees freedom of movement, freedom of association. So if, as a politician, for instance, my interest is not guaranteed in a particular political party, the law allows me to move to other political party. No. But if you have been elected, it shows that it's morally wrong because you came through that office through a platform, a political platform. So for you to abandon that vehicle and jump to the next vehicle, you know, people will just ask questions. But I think it has to do with the inability of the political parties to properly harness the interests of its members.
The High Court has ruled in favor of a PDP in one case and has ruled in another case. So people are confused about why there appear to be confusion about where the law or the constitution stands.
In fact, what the radical departure from the first decision that removed Governor Umahi of Ebonyi State and the one that stayed in office of Governor Ayade of Cross River State is because there has been, just last week, a court of appeal decision. You know, there's a hierarchy of courts in Nigeria. So there was a court of appeal decision that stated clearly the position of the constitution that you cannot remove a sitting governor because he defected from one political party to the other. Last 2 weeks or so, that wasn't the position. That is why Justice of the Federal High Court based his own judgment on his own interpretation of the law. But right now, as I speak to you, there is persistent a higher court decision. Because in Nigerian judicial system, there's a hierarchy of court. Because there's a principle that is called stare decisis or precedent. A precedent that is set by a higher court, the lower court is bound to follow that precedent.
Looking at the cases that have gone to the court, do you think those who sought to challenge the legitimacy of those who defected had a legal case at all?
Because the court has spoken, they don't have a legal case, but they have a moral case. Now, Nigeria is an evolving democracy. And of course, the constitution has made provision for itself to be amended from time to time. Now, if the Nigerian populace feel that defection is not just morally wrong, but they want to make it regulated by statute, what the Nigerian people have to do is just to amend the Nigerian constitution to include defection, that once you defect, you lose your seat. But also remember that in the legislative seat, the legislators are not don't have that kind of guarantee that executive have. In fact, as a legislator, by virtue of Section 68 of the Constitution, says if you move from one political party that sponsored you and you won the election to another party without justifiable reason, you stand the risk of losing your seat.
Leonard Anyongo is a Nigerian constitutional lawyer. He spoke with me from Calabar in Nigeria's Cross River State. The president of the Resident Doctors Association of Zambia says he has resigned as a medical practitioner from the civil service. Dr. Brian Sampa says his resignation will allow him to continue to advocate for the well-being of patients without restrictions. His comments come after critics say he was either fired or unable to withstand scrutiny from supervisors in the civil service. Dr. Sampa denies he was fired, saying he resigned. This because his work as a civil servant conflicts with his activism for the rights of vulnerable patients. For more about his decision, I reached Dr. Brian Sampa in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Yes, so I decided to take that step because my job was becoming a liability. I'm an advocate for quality health services and universal health coverage. And on top of that, I'm the president for the Resident Doctors Association. I've been brought up knowing the principles and being able to stand on the principles regardless of the repercussions. And when I noticed that in our country, we started facing a lot of challenges in terms of health provision, it became very difficult for me to keep quiet. So as an advocate, I spoke out about the lack of drugs. I spoke out about the shortages of manpower, but that may not have sat well with the authorities. And I saw there was a lot of intimidation, a lot of threats concerning my job, which became very difficult for me to balance advocating and keeping my job. So I decided to let go of my job so that I can concentrate on fighting for the rights of my members and for the Zambian people who deserve quality health services, which are not being provided at this point in time.
Well, but Brian, some people are suggesting that it is only when your job came under scrutiny that you decided to resign. Knowing very well that your advocacy is put to the test because you have a selfish parochial interest and not the well-being of the people, and you are playing politics.
Well, the people are saying that don't really understand what has been going on. Our advocacy started a long time ago, and last year I was key in the advocacy for better conditions of service for the doctors, for which I was fired. Now, the New Dawn government reinstated me. But the mistake was to think that me being reinstated was going to shut me up, and I was no longer going to be speaking out when something wrong is being done. Because it was anticipated that I'll be so loyal that even when wrong things are happening, I was not supposed to do anything. So when I saw that wrong things were being done, I decided to speak out. In trying to speak out, other people started to fight back, and thinking that I was being used by other people. The same thing which was suggested last year, that some opposition were using me, even now that's what they started suggesting, which is shallow thinking. Because if I was being used, I wouldn't be sacrificing. It's not like I found a job somewhere else. No, I don't have any job anywhere. But because my principles cannot allow me to continue working and sitting on that salary whilst people are dying and they are suffering just because I want to protect my job.
So what happens to your advocacy work now that you have officially resigned, effective immediately, from the civil service?
It now gives me more room to speak out without fear or favor and without thinking that somebody else will use my job. Now I'll be free to speak out and offer the best advice to the government without having to look at the hierarchy, without having to consider the job as a liability. Because it's very common in our African setup that whenever you are speaking and you are a civil servant, your job is used to shut you up. But in this case, since I no longer have anything tying me to the civil service, I only have a duty to the Zambian people, and I'm going to continue advocating and fighting for the rights of the Zambian people when it comes to health.
What's your next line of action? And do you still lead the doctors' organization that you head?
My resignation has got nothing to do with RDAZ. I'm still the Resident Doctors Association of Zambia president, and I'll still continue executing my duties until my term comes to an end, which is next year. What I've done today has got more to do with principle and the beliefs that I hold so dear, that I'm supposed to stand for the truth and always ensure that I bring out whatever wrongs are happening and advocate for quality health services in our country. I will continue advocating more, and I will continue serving my people diligently.
Dr. Brian Sampa is the president of the Residents Doctors Association of Zambia. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In the Netherlands, Prime Minister Mark Rutte has joined several current and former African leaders seeking to raise $30 billion a year in water investment in Africa. Rutte is the co-host of the UN 2023 International Decade for Action on Water Sustainable Development. He follows the recent launch of the International High-Level Panel on Water Investment in Africa in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. The panel includes the Prime Minister of the Netherlands and Senegal's President Macky Sall. It also includes Namibian President Haige Geingob and former Tanzanian President Jakaya Kikwete. The objective of the panel, officials say, is to develop pragmatic ways to mobilize $30 billion yearly until 2030 to help implement the Continental Africa Water Investment Program, as well as close the water investment gap on the continent. In the second part of this interview, I asked about managing expectations of the water investment in Africa and the role of the Netherlands government with Henk Ovink, the Netherlands Special Envoy for International Water Affairs and spokesperson for the Prime Minister.
Well, of course, it all depends on the partnership. The Netherlands is only one full range of partners, and I think this is also why we have high expectations. If this was a single-owned initiative, it wouldn't work. It is Africa-owned and Africa-initiated. That is of critical importance. This can't be something that comes from outside of Africa. The Netherlands only supports this because it comes from Africa and is owned by Africa. And the partners come from Africa. Governments, finance sector, private sector, global water partnerships, combined with organizations like the UN, the Global Commission and the Global Center on Adaptation, and other governments from across. And I think it's about this capacity, the talent that comes in with the Global Water Partnership and the Global Center on Adaptation that is of real help, also UNDP and UN agencies that are of critical importance to make sure that this is working. And we're only a small player in this, although we can help in validation, in inspiration, and help see things through, making the connections and helping to build coalitions. It is this global, local partnerships, global regional partnership, perhaps I should say, that is of critical importance. Because of that, and because of the clear focus and the work that's already being done in the prepping and the real ownership, we have high expectations. That is also why we want to put it on the agenda of next year's UN conference. We want to make sure that the world sees this as an opportunity, and that this partnership has best capacities for impact and for scaling those interventions, those approaches that work.
Hank, before you go, talk to me about the partnership between the Netherlands and the African Union and governments in Africa about these water investments and what the prospects are.
So, the Netherlands, as a government, works a lot with African partners, being it governments from a national level all the way down to the city level, in the context of WASH programs, water, sanitation and hygiene, of such critical importance, gender programs, where we make sure that women and girls are not only protected but capacitated for development sustainably, but also in the context of water security, where we work with countries and cities when it comes to climate resiliency in the face of climate disasters, floods, but also droughts, work on biodiversity programs. We do a lot on data and agriculture, where we use satellite data, also not alone, never alone, always in partnership with others, but making sure that farmers have access to satellite data so they understand when they have to work the land and when they have to, what type of water, what amount of water they have to use and in what part of the week or the month. Work with often with international organizations to make sure that we strengthen donor coordination, because a lot of partners want to work and work together, but often there's a lot of fragmentation, and Netherlands always has a clear focus that we coordinate as donor community to make sure that that coordination actually makes sense on the ground with the communities and the countries and the private sector and so forth. So we do many things across the continent of Africa with many communities and organizations, public and private, NGO and financial, to make sure that sustainable development can be scaled and replicated, and that it has the impact. And there's this blue thread, I call it, across a lot of those programs. And that is water, because water is connected to all these many aspects. And this is exactly why we think this is so important.
Henk Ovink is the Netherlands Special Envoy for International Water Affairs and spokesperson for the Prime Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Amsterdam. Cameroonian authorities said Friday that separatists had attacked a village on the Nigerian border earlier in the week, with local officials saying they touched at least 12 homes and killed 6 people. Authorities say the rebels appear to be targeting members of the Mbororo ethnic group, who the separatists accuse of collaborating with government troops. For VOA Moki, Edward Kezeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
The Cameroonian military said separatists shot indiscriminately in the air and torched houses in Bonghong, a western village in Ndu district on the border with Nigeria. The military did not say how many houses were burned, nor how many people were killed or wounded. Separatists have shared videos of the attack on Bonghong village on social media, including WhatsApp and Facebook. About 15 separatists in the videos say that they are avenging abuses committed against them by Cameroon's military and charge the government forces are using homes, farms, and cattle ranches of ethnic Mbororo and Fulani as military bases. The fighters are seen torching about 8 houses. Capo Daniel, deputy defense chief of the Ambazonia Defense Forces, a separatist group, says fighters in Du District, where Bonhong village is located, organized the attack.
The operation that took place in Du targeted the house of Bororo, who have been using his compound as a point where Cameroon military plan attack. As the Cameroon military have been unsuccessful to reach our camps that are located in remote areas, they have increasingly turned to Bororo people who are working hand in hand with the Cameroon military.
Capo said the Ambazonia Defense Forces consider Bororo people who collaborate with Cameroon government troops fighting separatists to be traitors and people who support separatist fighters as friends. Nkwenti Simon Doe is the highest government official in Dongamantung, the division where Ndu is located. He told Cameroon state broadcaster CRTV that a week hardly goes by without separatists attacking Bororo.
Armed groups benefit from the fact that the Mbororo populations are scattered over the hills to cause so much atrocities. They carried away many heads of their cattle, looted, killed, and burnt most of their structures.
Doe said that besides deploying the military to protect Mbororo, the government asked the ethnic group to create militias to collaborate with government troops in protecting goods and people. Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics estimates that there are over 1 million Bororo in the Central African state. More than 70% of the Bororo are cattle ranchers, owning about 70% of the estimated 3 million cattle in the English-speaking regions. Mohamed Umaru Abubakar is a Bororo rights activist and member of the Human Rights Committee of the Bororo Cultural and Development Association. The group works for the protection of the rights of ethnic Bororo. Abubakar says Bororo are victims of brutality because the ethnic group has refused to support separatists fighting to carve out an independent English-speaking state in the majority French-speaking Cameroon. Abubakar says the Mbororo are one of the ethnic groups that has suffered most from separatist brutality within the past 4 years.
3,842 cattle were seized or killed by the separatists, and over 5,000 cows have left the northwest to other regions, while others left to Nigeria. Over 195 million is being taken away from the Mbororo people in the name of ransom. As of date, the statistics we have is about 325 Mbororo people that are murdered by the separatists.
Abubakar said Cameroon should compensate Mbororo who have lost their cattle and protect ethnic group members from separatist attacks, looting, and killing. Separatists say they do not specifically target Mbororo, but they target all individuals and groups who collaborate with the Cameroon military. The United Nations says the Cameroon separatist crisis that degenerated into an armed conflict in 2017 has killed at least 3,300 people with 750,000 internally displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and VOA's Carol Van Dam for a special edition of Press Conference USA. Our guest is Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He offers his perspective and solutions on some of the world's most complex humanitarian crises, including the mounting crisis in Ukraine. Join us for PCUSA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, a top U.S. military commander says African countries dealing with violent extremism need to enact good governance, a stronger rule of law, and inclusion of marginalized communities if they want to promote stability. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Africa has seen an increase in terror groups operating across the continent in recent years. Al-Shabaab in East Africa, Al-Qaeda and Islamic State affiliates expanding in the Sahel, and Boko Haram around the Lake Chad Basin are among the most prominent. On Thursday, the head of the U.S. Military Special Operations Command Africa, Rear Admiral Jamie Sands, said African countries need better governance and greater cooperation if they are to stop the threat of terrorism.
No nation can solve this challenge or this problem alone. Partnerships are key. Prevention of extremism through governance reforms and progress is an easier path than fighting established violent extremists through kinetic activity. Values matter. Transparency, accountability, and inclusion are key as we move forward. International investment is critical, and this investment must be paired with security, good governance, and aid.
Terrorist activities has displaced at least 33 million people continent-wide and contributed to political instability in countries like Mali, Burkina Faso, and Somalia. Sands says violent extremism erodes the relations between a government and its citizens.
The lack of security, and with, in some regions, a perception of disadvantagement that takes place between the government and the population, really form to create an environment where the population loses faith in the government and either decides deliberately to overthrow the government through a coup, or as we saw in one country, Burkina Faso, we think it was a mutiny that turned into a coup.
In January of this year, Burkina Faso's military removed the president and suspended the constitution. Military officers said rising extremist violence and the deterioration of security forced them to seize power from the civilian-led government. Militant groups have especially thrived in neglected border areas where governments have little presence and communities on both sides of the border fight for whatever resources are available in the area. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says 40% of violent events and deaths occur within 100 kilometers of a border between two African countries. Simiyu Werunga is the head of the Geneva Center for Africa Security. He says the lack of cooperation between African governments is a key driver of terrorism on the continent.
So what we lack in Africa is serious mechanisms, government to government, to deal with these issues and deal with it for good. In West Africa, we have the Sahel region. True, Sahel has its own grouping, ECOWAS has its own grouping, but they don't seem to be working together. This gives this organization space to create themselves and actually to counter what governments are doing by creating more smaller splinter groups so that they spread the chaos and make it difficult for governments to deal with them.
Sands says the U.S. government will help mend broken relations between governments and communities and encourage good governance as a best way of defeating terrorism. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Ugandan farmers are battling an outbreak of African armyworms that have destroyed acres of crops in more than 15 districts. Farmers say the available pesticides haven't been effective against the fast-spreading pests. For VOA, Catherine Nambi reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The caterpillar-like African armyworms feed mostly on the young leaves of grass, coffee, millet, sorghum, maize and pineapples, among other crops. While the grass is for pastures, the rest are major cash and food crops, so farmers are counting their mounting losses from the worms. John Onakalit is a farmer in Uganda's Kasese district. He says in just 1 week, farmers in his village have lost about 50 acres of crops to the worms.
They are all active. When we come in the morning, they are active. During day, when we are in the garden, they are active. So I don't know whether at night they are also active. But I believe they are also active. Because you can leave the garden in the evening when your garden is okay, and then you come back in the morning, you find that the garden is empty. So I could say they are active 24 hours.
The farmers are agitated that several pesticides on the market have failed to kill the worms. Patience Mirembe is a farmer who has lost about 2 acres of her maize crop to the worms. She said she has spent a lot of money buying pesticides to spray, but the worms just keep munching.
A pesticide we are putting, we are not even sure whether it will be able to kill them. And we are hoping for the government maybe to intervene and make research, make samples on these armyworms and see whether there is some appropriate pesticide which can kill them.
The Agriculture Ministry attributes the outbreak to drought conditions and are hopeful the pests will be suppressed when the rains set toward the end of the month. District entomologists have been placed on high alert to monitor and sensitize communities on the steps to take once the worms are sighted. Wilberforce Semiga is an agricultural officer in Uganda's Luwero district, one of those bearing the brunt of the worms. He has urged farmers to do routine checks on their crops and to spot the caterpillars in the early stages of infestation.
With this pest, the way it invades, it needs a community approach in terms of management, and farmers are encouraged at least to manage them as soon as they realize the first population, because it multiplies at quite a rapid rate, in that if you wait for some more, for a week, you'll find almost over an acre is destroyed by these same pests. So there are several chemicals and agrochemicals on market which are able to manage this. I just encourage farmers to get access to those chemicals and be alert and manage these pests so that they don't spread and multiply to cause intensive damage to our crop.
According to available information, once the worms progress beyond the larva stage, they can be difficult to control and are capable of destroying 70% of a crop. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas in Puga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Sudan has been confirmed as hosts for the SECAFA Under-20 Championship, which will also act as the zonal qualifiers for the Under-20 Africa Cup of Nations. The Executive Committee of the Council of African Football Associations on Tuesday awarded Sudan the opportunity to host the competition after they had earlier sent in their bid together with Rwanda. It will be 8 years since Sudan last hosted the SECAFA tournament. The country last hosted the SECAFA Kagame Cup in 2013, which was won by Burundi's Vital. Also, the Senior Women's Championship, slated for May 22nd to June 5th, will be hosted by Uganda. Burundi and Uganda will represent the region at the Africa Cup of Nations women's event to be held in Morocco. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has announced the dates for upcoming draws of the Africa Cup of Nations Côte d'Ivoire 2023 group stages, Chan Algeria 2023, and the Women's Africa Cup of Nations Morocco 2022. The group stages of the Africa Cup of Nations commence in June 2022, and the draw for the group stages will be conducted on Tuesday, April 19th, 2022. The Women's Africa Cup of Nations kicks off in July, and the draw will be held in Morocco on April 25th. Chan Algeria 2023 qualifiers will kick off in July of this year. And the second season of the Basketball Africa League resumed on Saturday when the Nile Conference got underway in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Six teams, defending champions Egypt's Zamalek, BS Espoir Fukasha of DRC, South Africa's Cape Town Tigers, Cobra Sport of South Sudan, Cameroon's FAP, and Petro de Luanda of Angola are competing in a round robin for four spots at next month's playoffs in Rwanda. Last month, Rwanda Energy Group, Tunisia Side US, Monastra, Morocco's ASL, and Guinean outfit Slack booked their places in May's playoffs. And last week, Kenya's Judith Jeptum broke the women's record at the Paris Marathon, while Ethiopia's Deso Gelmisa won the men's race. The 26-year-old Jeptum finished the 42.2-kilometer race in 2 hours, 19 minutes, and 48 seconds. The 2021 Abu Dhabi Marathon winner ran a personal best and broke the course record of 2 hours, 20 minutes, and 55 seconds set by Purity Rionoripo of Kenya in 2017. Fantu Jima of Ethiopia was second, more than 3 minutes behind Jeptum, and her compatriot Besu Sado was third. In the men's race, Gelmisa out-sprinted fellow countryman and 2021 Chicago Marathon winner Seifu Tura to finish in 2 hours, 5 minutes and 7 seconds. And that's about it for this edition of Northern Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As African states emerged from colonialism to nation states and membership in the United Nations, they have always striven for a just and stable world order. Obviously, in present circumstances of the repercussions in diverse ways of Russia's war in Ukraine, no one can say with great honesty that the world order is stable. And this is the problem that is being faced by many African states and their colleagues in the global south. What role can they play? They have seen over the years that their issues are not always the paramount one for the rest of the world. Former Secretary General Boutros-Ghali, when he took office in the early 90s, remarked that the rich man's war in Bosnia draws far more attention than the poor man's war in Somalia of the early 90s, what was a greater disaster. And yet, African states and those in the global south have been asked to take side in this titanic struggle in Ukraine. And many see it not only a war between Russia and Ukraine, but a war between the West and Russia. And that doubles the dilemma. The Security Council and the General Assembly have been discussing the Ukraine matter for several weeks now. The Security Council, like in the past, remains paralyzed when it is confronted with hot-button issue relating to the maintenance of international peace and security. And the Uniting for Peace Resolution have turned to the General Assembly to see what it could do. But in reality, the Assembly can only give you the pulse of the global society, and it has been doing so. But the results have not been pleasing to the Western powers, who really and sincerely believe Russia's intervention in Ukraine is so clear-cut that it does not allow for any ambiguity or neutrality. But this is not the way the issue is seen by African states of the global south. Surely, as human beings, they feel great pain and anguish when they see the videos that are shown 24/7 on television, and not only the pictures, but the commentaries that accompanies this picture. So one should not draw any conclusion that the African states and the global community do not feel the pain of the Ukrainian people. But they have seen tragedies and pain in their own societies and often neglected by the wider world. What then should be done? I think if we look at the votes in the General Assembly last week on the resolution to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council, you could see the clear division and divergence of position of the wider world. For the resolution to suspend, the vote was 93, against was 24, abstention 58. But under the terms of the General Assembly regulations and rules, what counts only were the 93 in favor and the 24 against. And that was why the Russia was suspended, which was quickly followed by the Russian representative deciding that Russia was going to withdraw. If you look at the African counts, it's even more of a problem. African states that voted for the resolution to suspend, 10. And African states that voted to oppose that resolution, 9. And there were 24 abstentions, and 11 African states were not present for the voting. So you can see the problem. And yet, Africans know, as the rest of the global community know, that even if though they are not participating in the war, they are always the victims as usual. We are now talking about higher food prices because wheat comes from Russia and Ukraine. We are now talking about higher fuel prices because of Western comprehensive sanctions against Russia. And we are now know that there is going to be increased cost of living, and maybe many African economies will fall back. Then what is the Security Council going to do? We know that efforts to reform that council has failed, and failed miserably because of reluctance by some of the permanent members. And this secretariat, which is a major organ set up to come in to play in such crucial times, is in life support. Many, many so-called reforms in the 90s and turn of the century have paralyzed numerous reforms of the secretariat, particularly in its organization and the international civil service has weakened that service in terms of its character and representation. It is therefore difficult today for the international civil service to perform its usual roles in tackling peace and security as it has done in previous decades, particularly under Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Sitaki mingine mami, you're all mine. Baby, all this love's for you. I know a couple things that we can do.
Por tu amor, calypso, calypso, calypso.
You think she was with the flip mode? You got me going crazy just by how them hips go. I told her I'm not a dancer, but she persists though. Guess I'ma lean back while you do the calypso. It's up with your time to lean back twice. Don't take your feet, it's leap mortal, girl, I clean up nice. I got the bread and you need that slice. What I'm offering, it was sure you ain't seen that light. It's a kipindi, that kukeuza am shindi. Jackpot, but do I say, na siringi. Destination is a kupeleta, pia ni nyingi. Lunch is lando, dina tukulia malindi.
I wanna make you happy, my only.
Oh,
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, do not look where the harvest is plentiful, but where the people are kind. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.